Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special show today. We just wrapped up the Heritage Radio Network Kickstarter. Great job, guys, Jack, Aaron, and everybody. I know you guys hit your target, and it's really special to see what's going to happen here at heritageradionetwork.org. And going back tonight, we did a show back in February, recorded at the Blind Tiger in the West Village. It's a special show for New York City Beer Week. We have a Vermont beer show with Dave Broderick from Worthy Burger and Blind Tiger, and Chad Rich from Prohibition Pig. So it's a special pre-recorded show. Thanks for tuning in, guys, and congratulations to Heritage Radio Network on hitting their Kickstarter. Take it away, Jack.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. And today is February 25th. We're doing a special post-Brewer's Choice show live from the Blind Tiger in West Village, Manhattan. Beer Sessions Radio is brought to you by Union Beer Distributors, suppliers of world-class ales and lagers. So this is a pretty special show. We're here at the Blind Tiger. First time we're doing a remote show. We're going to air this in March sometime. And we've got some great people. Guys, introduce yourselves.
Hey, Jimmy. It's Dave Broderick from the Blind Tiger. Chef Tommy Harder from the Blind Tiger.
It's Ian Campbell from Beanery Brewing and Worthy Kitchen.
And Chad Rich from Prohibition Pig in Waterbury, Vermont.
Well, cheers, guys.
Cheers.
So I know you guys came down for the Brewer's Choice event last night, but the real reason we're having the show is talking about what's going on in Vermont. You know, let's start with you, Dave. Tell us about the Beanery and what you're doing.
Yeah, I got a phone call from Dave Yarrington at head brewer Smutty Nose last May saying that they were going to hang on to their old brewery and rename it Smut Labs for experimental stuff. And he said, I've got all this excess capacity. Are you interested in doing a project? And at first I was like, the last thing we need is more beer. But I don't know why. I've always had this idea of doing a coffee brewery. And so it started there. We just started doing test recipes and then came out with our first brand coffee IPA right before Christmas in Vermont, and now we've got Coffee Milk Stout. And Ian Campbell, who used to work here at the Tiger, is now up in Vermont with me at Worthy Kitchen, is one of the partners in Beanery as well. So he's actually going to be running sales in New York City, going back and forth between both places.
So Ian, what was it like for you getting involved with these projects up in Vermont? I mean, you were living in New York.
Yeah, I was in New York here at the Blind Tiger for, I always say 10 years, but I think it was 8, from when we moved to the new spot on Bleecker Street. And actually, if you actually remember when we moved here the first time, it took a little while for the liquor license to kick in, and we were actually doing a coffee program here, which is how I actually got involved in the company with Dave.
It was like the worst year of our life.
So coffee, actually I came to it from the coffee end. I didn't know anything about beer, but I learned pretty quick working here at the Blind Tiger. So I was here and moved up to help open the Worthy Kitchen and was just hoping that Dave would invite me to join one of his projects, and busted butt for a year, and then we...
And now you know what it's like.
And now I know what it's like. Yeah, the beer's been moving well up in Vermont, but I'm really excited to bring it down to New York. Last night at the Brewer's Choice, we were getting really good response. I think it's going to be fun to come into the New York market for sure.
That's great. Let's talk to Tommy. So yeah, you've been here for the chef at the Blind Tiger for how many years now?
Almost 4 years now. 4 years in February or April. So yeah, been here for a little while.
And I know you've been doing some beer and food things. What food did you make last night for the Brewer's Choice?
Oh, yeah, I made some jambalaya. Actually made it with beer, too. You know, it's because, you know, last week was Mardi Gras, and so I just kind of thought of the idea of doing something that would, you know, be a little festive and a little bit, I guess, more or less logistically simple for me to serve. So I had a nice little one-pot meal of a mix of both brown rice, black forbidden black rice that was cooked with beer, chicken, andouille sausage, and shrimp. Definitely was another favorite too. I had a lot of people keep on coming back for Force and Fist, and just trying to feed as many people as I could.
You ran out halfway through the event.
Well, it was great stuff, man. And Dave, what beer is this?
This is Chad's beer from Prohibition Pig, Chad's new brewery, which I'd love to hear more about.
Yeah, this is our it's one of our session beers, Session Blonde with Mosaic Hops.
It's delicious.
Yeah, that's you know, one of the main things we want to do is just always have very sessionable beers on tap. That's we'll do bigger beers at times, but with the new brewery, we just went from Lawson's old one barrel system. Then I acquired some new equipment for fermenters and bright tanks, but also pretty much started the Vermont Brewing Museum. I got John Kimmick's old mash tun and then Sean Hill's old brew kettle, but then ended up getting John Kimmick's brew kettle as well. So.
And that's John Kimmick from the of Alchemist fame.
There you go.
Is it officially the Vermont Brewers Museum? Or
that's other people have even said that. So now we've gone from Lawson's old one barrel to the seven barrel. We bought the building behind us that sat vacant since the flood of Irene. Renovated it. That now has given us outdoor seating and as well an additional 50 seats inside and much more brewing capacity with the seven barrel with a lot of room to grow in there too. So with that said, having that the extra capacity, we always want to do very sessionable beers because that way you can drink more.
So, yeah, I mean, driving in Vermont is a much bigger issue than it is here down in New York City, and you constantly have to think about that. You're trying to figure out how can you sell them that third beer, and it's the only way is at least to have a couple of lower ABV beers.
So I'll tell you, this is great,
at least a possibility.
Man.
Yeah, it's really lots of flavor.
Yeah. I'm really liking session beers. You know, we come from an event. You heard you guys talking about festivals before. I'm always amazed at festivals. Some people go in with these hard, heavy-hitting beers that are like 10% barrel age, and I'm like, you can't really appreciate that in a festival setting. No. But I also find, generally, I want to have more session beers anyways.
And it's a harder beer to make, you know, to make really well. Just like Pilsners are tough to make, you know, because they're so clean, there's nothing to hide behind. Session beers, to make a really good, smooth one, has lots of flavor, but isn't over, you know, unbalanced in some way. It's a tough beer to do well, so it's always good
test. What other beers are you making now?
Right now, we have 6 or 7 our own beers on tap. The goal is to get it up to somewhere around probably 10 or 12 and then still always be a tap room as well. Having access to Hill and Lawson and Alchemist beers, you know, we got to keep those on too. But we try to vary the style from definitely a lot of hoppy stuff. We're still loving that. But Nate Johnson's our brewer, and he loves doing darker beers as well. Stouts, brown ales, porters, you know, and as well we've done some one-offs that were a little different. We did our take of something we called Brass Monkey, and it was a malt liquor, 7% malt liquor lager that was with orange zest in it. And but we will start doing more lagers as well, and especially Pilsners. Mm-hmm. I feel like Pilsners are one of the beers I'm being drawn to the most right now. So
and there's a lot of, I mean, there are some Vermont Pilsners, but nobody's really kind of gone in there and sort of done something really super interesting. They're all really well made, but nothing that really jumps. So I think that's a really good style. And it's popular in Vermont too. A lot of, you know, it's one of our biggest selling styles at both our places. I'm sure the same is for you.
Yeah, great. You know, hops, summertime, lager, there again, sits lighter on you. Not going to weigh you down. You can have 3 instead of 2.
Right. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask Chad, like, and we were sort of talking about this last night a little bit, is managing a list when you have access to Hill Farmstead and Lawson and the Alchemist, and then you've got your own beers as well, is like, how do you, you know, make sure everything's moving because we have trouble, you know, Hill Farmstead's suddenly going to have a lot more beer available, and we're going to have a lot more lines of it. And we already have trouble just managing 2 lines, getting people to drink other stuff. You know, everybody that comes in there, that's all they want, either that or Lawson. And we can't get the Alchemist. So how do you, you know, we have to take take Hill Farmstead off sometimes to move other things. So how, you know, you've got it even worse than we do because you've got everything.
We definitely noticed that at first, and it was really a lot of trial and error of picking out what other beers were going to be interesting to fill the voids, and they definitely had to be more of a unique style. It's kind of hard to put a hoppy beer up from outside of Vermont when you have all these other great hop brewers up there, so that's something that we definitely don't put a lot of that style up from breweries out of state. You know, it's just kind of plugging in maybe some of the esoteric stuff that people want to see, sour beers, just trying to keep balance throughout all the spectrum of beer styles.
All right. And Ian, like, tell us more about the scene up there. I mean, between Worthy Kitchen, the Beanery, Prohibition Pig.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, definitely a lot of people when they're walking into the bar come in. Their first one, I would say, is usually if we have a Lawson's or if there's anything, one of the, you know, Alchemists or Lawson's or Hill Farmstead, they're coming looking for that. But I think people are pretty adventurous when they're looking for their second beer there. They're asking the bartenders what's going on, what's local, what's kind of fresh, what's going. So I think, you know, we could steer people towards other styles. And, you know, I think the hoppy beers are definitely still what they're looking for first. But, you know, we all talk about it in the bar beforehand, kind of what's new, and get the staff trained up on other styles and steering people in that direction.
Cheers to you guys.
Yeah,
we all were at this event last night. We're all a little quiet.
Right.
I'm quiet down with my throat, you know. But it's been really cold in the city for the last few weeks. Is it like that up in Vermont? People hibernate in the winter?
Well, Chad was saying it was on the Monday night, it was 27 below in Waterbury. I think it was 15 below. We're a little bit further south. So that's without wind chill. So it's been, and it's been like that off and on. You know, we have a couple of decent days and then it just drops down. So, and it does, you know, affect business a little bit up there. People are certainly more willing to go outside. They're more used to it. But you know, if you're home and it's 15 below zero, I mean, you're not going to jump in your car and drive a half hour to go to some place, you know. So it definitely can slow things down a little bit.
We have been lucky with the snow, though.
Yeah, it's been one of the best skiing winters we've had in a long, long time, and it looks like it's going to last for a long time, which is huge because one of our slower times is when the mountains close down, the whole state turns to mud, and everybody seems to disappear. So if we, you know, the longer the winter for us, the better.
Yeah. All right, guys. Yeah. Well, let's just talk about some things like beer festivals. I mean, so when people go up to Vermont, they like to hit some of the breweries. They go to your places, the Worthies and Prohibition Pig. Are there any festivals that are worth going up to?
Well, that's what Chad and I were just talking about before the show, and there's tons of them. Chad knows even. I mean, obviously there's Vermont Brewers Festival in July, usually the third week of July, but there's a whole bunch of new ones now too. There's the one on Labor Day, which I don't remember the name. It's like the Hop Jam. That's it. And neither of us went, but apparently it was really good. All the great breweries were there, the great Vermont breweries. And but there's like something. It seems like there's something every weekend.
Literally is. There's September Fest. That's a big one down at Mad River Valley. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's sort of a Lawson's home base, so people really flock to that just to see his beers. And he usually coordinates a beer release at that same time. So it's been great for Vermont, though, having all these things, because it's not like you got to come one particular weekend. If you're a beer enthusiast and be there that weekend, you can come almost any weekend now, and there's something going on somewhere.
And we need people to come to the state. We're so small, you know, our local population is pretty tiny. So we need that influx of people, and it's been a real boon, you know, over the last 5, 6, 7 years with the Alchemist and Hill Farmstead drawing so many people into the state and Lawson. It makes a big difference for the restaurants. I mean, especially, you know, going back to mud season when things can really slow down, they almost always schedule bottle releases during that time to help everybody out. And it really makes, you know, at least keeps the weekends busy and is a huge help. So it's great the way the breweries kind of pay attention to you know, what's going on in the restaurant, bar and restaurant world, and helping them out as much as they can.
All right, guys. This is a good one. Cheers, everybody. No brain left.
I think next we need some coffee beer. What do you think?
Let's try some of that. Yeah. And it seems like a lot of the people from the Blind Tiger have been going up to Vermont. Have you been up there, Tom?
I have actually had a chance to visit the Worthy Kitchen, but not the Worthy Burger yet. We were going up there because we had an event down here we do. It's farm to bar. So I was actually going up there to get a bunch of produce from farmers and bringing it back down. Also a lot of meat. So I had a reason for a road trip and had a good time. Got to go see Ian and a couple other former employees like Jonna Tuck that oh, I guess not Jonna Tuck anymore. It's
Jonna Knight.
Sorry. She used to work here as well as another bartender and ended up getting taken from us to go up to Worthy Kitchen. But, yeah, no, it was a great place, and I had a great time. Can't remember what beers I drank because, I didn't have to worry about driving, so I got the
joy. You do that every year, don't you? You have some of the Vermont farmers come down, you do a little festival. November?
It's, we did first of December, so just right after Thanksgiving. Because of the harvest and stuff like that, a lot of the farmers then can actually come down. And some of the ones that participate from Fable Farms, they also make cider as well, and they bring it down, and we have it on tap, as well as some other Vermont beers. And so it's kind of one of those one times that we can actually get Hill Farmstead down here as well and stuff like that. So it's kind of a nice event to do. But for me, it's really always really nice, too, because then I kind of get to do a whole spread, a buffet, and all that kind of stuff. And make some different every time, too. So get to use, you know, great produce and create different dishes that I really don't do here anyway. So, yeah, it's always a good time for me, even though it's always a lot of work.
All right, guys. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're doing a special show live at the Blind Tiger in the West Village, Manhattan. We've got some great guys here, Dave Broderick, Chad Rich, Prohibition Pig, and some other folks. So we're talking about the new beer that Dave's making, the Beanery.
Yeah, so right now, in fact, we're drinking our what we call our Costa Rican IPA. At Beanery, our real main focus, obviously, is coffee beers. And so for us, obviously, the beer is important, but also the bean. And we try to showcase the bean as much as the beer, if not even a little bit more so. So for this, we made a very citrusy IPA, and then we paired it with a Costa Rican bean from this small farm that sort of specializes in beans that when you roast them properly, they get kind of a citrusy, sort of a peach, lemon, and a little brown sugar, too, which I think, you know, comes out pretty well. And then the second beer, which we just came out with, the coffee milk stout, that one really showcases a Ethiopian bean with sort of a tart berry flavor that kind of breaks up the chocolate. So we've been having a lot of fun just sort of, you don't know always what's going to come out of these beans. It's a lot of fun, you know, it's a big mystery. And to, you know, finally try it after you've been waiting four or five weeks, it's you don't know what you're always going to get. But so far it's been really
interesting. Why did you put together coffee and beer?
You know, maybe it goes back to when we were, you know, you'd think it would be the last thing I would do since I didn't really enjoy being a coffee house. But for some reason, I've always been fascinated by coffee beers. And I think that a lot of, you know, most breweries make one, but they usually do it maybe once a year, maybe twice a year. and they don't necessarily focus on the beans and the roaster very much. You know, they don't have time and all that. So I kind of felt like if we really just focused on that, you know, we could come up with some really, we could get good at making coffee beers. You know, because it's not actually an easy thing to put the two things together and do it well. It took us a long time to figure out our process, and we're still figuring it out. So I just think the two go well together, and I think that to just do, you know, just to create a brewery now, you kind of need to have an angle because there's just so many places out there doing great beer. So you kind of have to figure out, like, what your way in is, and for us, it's coffee beer, and it gives a whole other line of stories through those beans, and bringing these two things together to sort of, you know, make beer interesting, you know, for us.
Do you have like a special coffee connection?
We do. We use Claudia Barrett at CQ Roasters in Bedford, New Hampshire. She's a Q grader. There's like 300 Q graders in America. And that's just a huge process that you go through of training and testing, and both in tasting and knowledge about beans. And she spends a lot of time traveling around the world, finding these like really cool small farms. And you know, and we live up in Vermont, which is all about small farms. We're trying to support them, and she's doing the same thing in various parts of the world. So it's kind of fun to, you know, get to work with some of these guys and hear their stories. The second beer that we came out with, the coffee milk stout, we use these Ethiopian beans, and the farm is a super small farm run by the only female grower in Ethiopia, and she's got all, I think 80% of her workers are women, and they call it the Women's Coffee Project. And they're doing a documentary film on her now. She's like a real rock star in the coffee world. So to get to kind of like showcase her beans, and then to have it have such a big impact on the beer that we made, where it really, you know it's hers. It's kind of cool. It's been sort of fun. I can't wait till she tries it.
No, it's great. And Chad, what do you think of this beer?
Love it.
Have you had the beanery before?
I'm a big coffee fanatic as well, and big fan of having a little caffeine in my alcohol. I like that contradiction there. It allows you to keep going. So, no, all the beers I've had so far have been awesome that they've been doing.
So it's not just flavor, the caffeine actually comes through.
It does, and we notice it. Ian and I experimented on ourselves one time. We went to an event at Mount Snow in southern Vermont, and I don't think I'd had more than two 12-ounce glasses of our beer. At that point, we only had the Costa Rican IPA, so I was like, Ian, let's see what happens if we have four pints. And so it was, I think it was like 6 o'clock in the evening, and we just started, and it goes down pretty easy. And as you're drinking it, I notice you notice the coffee less. It's like anything. It's like when you drink a smoked beer, you notice the smoke less and less. Your palate adjusts to it. And so after the second or third one, I noticed that I was like shouting at people, you know, and I was becoming more and more obnoxious. And by the fourth one, I was like, I really just had to calm myself down, take a little time out. Ian, who drinks like 10 cups of coffee a day, he wasn't as affected as I was. So.
Yeah, I went to 6, 7, or 8 pints that night.
Yeah, you went way beyond.
This is the beer you can drive with.
It's a really good drinking and driving beer.
Well, cheers again, guys. Mm. This is the big cheers. You got a great place here, Dave. You know, I know a lot of people. We got Tommy, the chef, Catherine's your manager partner, Luke, our buddy Luke's working
right
here.
Luke's so, very important.
You know, I know you went through a lot of challenges opening this place, but in the old days, I mean, you guys were a little on Hudson in the West Village.
10th Street in Hudson, yeah.
Tell us what made that so special. How did you build this little mystique?
You know, a lot of times I think it's just time. You know, we've been doing it. We've got our 20th anniversary coming up, almost exactly a year. It'll be March 15th of next year. 2016 will be our 20th. So that's a long time. And, you know, you build up, it's a long time to build up a following. And I don't know. We've always been really into, obviously, craft beer and trying to keep it fresh for ourselves. Always trying to figure out new ways to do it, to approach it, to think about it. Bringing the food component in. The old place, we didn't have a kitchen. We did have a kitchen, but we didn't use it. And so that was a big, when we moved in this location, the new location with a kitchen, we knew it was going to be a big deal. And luckily at that time, craft beer and food, the whole pairing of it was really coming on strong. So when Tommy came aboard, that was like a really big deal, you know, because he's got a great palate and a great idea in terms of bringing flavors together. You know, it's like his brain is it's pretty incredible. I can't always follow it, but because it's going a million miles an hour. But
Tommy, what's really a dish on the menu that doesn't sell well, but you wish would sell more?
Dude, that's kind of a hard question because they all do pretty well.
exactly.
Right now, you know, actually, the cassoulet is a really good one, and I think just because like something like that, it's a French dish, but everybody knows what a cassoulet is. But yeah, it's a great winter stew. Beans, you know, duck confit, there's pancetta in there, and it's all actually braised in beer. Usually use a lighter beer like a Pilsner for that one. And so, I mean, like, even using beer in the food is something that I do a lot here. And so it's one of those things that, like, you know, people just don't know what the word actually means, you know. They probably just kind of look right past it, go right for the grilled cheese tomato soup or one of the more comfort foods that we always have here. But, yeah, I mean, there's... I don't really have any favorites on the menu there. Like, I want to, like, say, like, oh, you should always have this.
I like cassoulet.
Yeah.
And that's pretty interesting that you have it. I didn't even realize you had it on the menu here.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the seasonal things. It's not on the menu all the time, but during the wintertime, definitely the colder weather calls for, you know, more of a comfort foods like that. It definitely is something that's nice to do during, you know, these colder months and stuff. And so it definitely, like... You know, come springtime, that's going to come off and stuff. It's going to be a little bit lighter. It's going to be on the menu as far as our entrees go and stuff like that. So I don't know exactly what that means because I'm still waiting for it to get warmer. It seems like it's getting colder. So right now, yeah, it's doing good, and I enjoy it.
And, Chad, I've been to Prohibition Pig. Do you guys have a food program too?
We do. It's definitely the restaurant side. We've got a pretty big kitchen. Well, it's a small kitchen with a lot of people working in there because a lot of Fridays and Saturdays we'll do somewhere between 500 or 600 people serving them food. So it's kind of, you know, fast paced, moves through pretty quick. But I feel fortunate. Tommy puts out this amazing food out of this kitchen here, and it's such a small space, but
in all electric.
All electric.
But I mean, the thing at Prohibition Pig has great food, and Chad, who was born in Vermont and grew up until about 8 or 9 in Vermont,
and then 12,
and then moved down to North Carolina.
Yep.
And so it's kind of cool. He's got sort of both a Vermont and a Southern connection, and which totally was reflected in your food, and used it, you know, doing Southern barbecue, doing North Carolina barbecue in particular, and you spent a lot of time researching smokers and how you were going to do it, and, you know, because I remember like talking to you about that, and I mean the amount of time and thought that you put into that, it was pretty impressive.
Damn, thanks, Dave. I was going to talk up this place more too, just because it is such an icon. The pig part does reference that we do Eastern North Carolina chop barbecue. I lived with a 7th generation hog farmer. He and I were roommates from the time we were like 19 to 23, and we used to do these annual pig pickings in our backyard to the point that the final one we had when we were 23, we served 750 people and had 28 kegs. So that whole experience right there definitely played into the business plan. But it helps create some of the efficiency we do, because we have to pre-smoke all these meats in advance. It's not like you just take an order and then go smoke an individual serving for 12 hours. Customer might be a wreck by the time you get back if that happened. But
makes them drink that third beer.
Yeah,
plenty of time.
So you have smokers. You have outdoor smokers or indoor smokers?
Yeah, we have 4 smokers now. We just bought another one last fall, and it's good. Actually, this new smoker I got has been game changer, and learned about it from when we did. I helped cook with a guy named Sam Jones from the Skylight Inn out of North Carolina,
which is a very famous place.
Very famous. Known as one of the best barbecue places in the country. And he has been invited by Danny Myers to do the Big Apple Barbecue for the past 2 years. So Sam invited me to come down and cook with him for that, which cooking means I sit there and burn wood all night and shovel coals, but it was awesome. So no, but there was another smoker company down here that they had just come out with this one model and were showing it there, and we ended up getting one of the first ones to come up for them to manufacture, and it's been a game changer for us.
Yeah, what's the difference in this smoker compared to the other ones?
Well, the biggest thing is most people, when they're smoking meats, they're doing cuts. So most of these smokers, some of them can hold a massive amount of meat, but they're...
Like shoulders?
Yeah, it's all cuts. Being that Eastern North Carolina is pretty specific for doing the whole animal, not many people make a commercial smoker that can do that. This smoker that they came out with, they call it the double wide, and it will hold a whole animal in there, which is great for us because our other smokers were just very labor intensive. And there was a couple of times where, we almost burned down the pig with the smoker going out there and some flame ups. So
I think Frank Jones has had that problem. How many times have they burned down their smoke house?
That happens in the industry.
Yeah. It's a big problem. I read the book Cooked by Michael Pollan. He features Frank Jones in the Skyline.
Yep.
And they talk about that. It's a constant danger. I mean, all those places would be illegal if you tried to open it up now, but they're all grandfathered. But they constantly burn to the ground. It's like this, you know, big danger of the business.
How many pigs do you go through a week at Prohibition Pig?
I don't even know. My chef
Five,
keeps
ten,
up with
20.
That. Probably in the neighborhood of, 4 to 6. Because we also do a lot of brisket. We do a lot of chicken. And then as well our burgers. So it's kind of a rounded menu. It's not just the barbecue. But talking about the local food scene, there's definitely a lot of great small farms up in Vermont, and one of them that we aligned ourselves with a few years ago, it's working out well because he actually picks up all of our spent grain from the brewery. So when he comes down to bring a pig, he picks up the grain, and next time he brings a pig, he just constantly brings back empty grain bins for us. So I like how it goes full circle like that.
Dave, how did you guys meet, you and Chad?
Chad, I think I met you when you were bartending at American Flatbread.
Yes.
In Burlington.
Yep.
That's when we first met, and then we just started hanging out. We had a lot of similar interests, and Chad knew everybody, so it was a great way for me, being a New Yorker and moving to Vermont. It was a great way to meet people through him, and he had a lot of contacts, and he was also very much thinking about Prohibition Pig then, and trying to figure out how to make it work and where. And I always love talking about the restaurant business. So we just started, trying to figure out, I was trying to figure out my stuff. He was trying to figure out his stuff, bouncing ideas off of each other. I actually went to a prototype dinner at his apartment, the infamous Bat Cave, which was in Winooski, this amazing apartment. You can't even call it an apartment. I don't know what it was, but
it's
was
a mill building.
Yeah, a mill building, all stone, like 30-foot ceilings, and he had this really cool bar counter sort of set up, and he did a bunch of the food that he was thinking about doing on the Prohibition menu, and we all got to taste it. And he even had, at that point, you already had like POS stuff, for his business that didn't exist.
I had a menu made.
He had a menu made. I mean, it was like he was so organized. I was like, this is definitely going to happen. You could just tell.
And I actually knew of Dave before he knew me just because of the Tiger. I actually remember going to the old Tiger location, and this is pre-smartphone and whatnot, and going, where is it? I was very disappointed. I didn't know what had happened. And because I got into craft beer in the 90s because of the Brickskeller down in D.C. I started going there, and then through Beer Advocate and things like that, I heard of the Blind Tiger, and this place being just one of the first to do what they've done. I was so looking forward to getting in here. So Yeah, fortunately, I missed the time when there were only a coffee house, but it's all worked out now.
Yeah, right. Talk about invitations. Ian was the first person to serve me a beer here for my interview. Getting a job here as a chef. So.
Yeah, our interview system is a lot better than probably some other people's.
I mean, Dave was saying that it's going to be coming up on 20 years, and there are bartenders. You know, Ozzy's pouring beer right now. We've been with him for 20 years.
Actually, even longer. Ozzy and I, when I was a bartender back in the late 80s, early 90s, Ozzy and I were working together at the River Run down in Tribeca. So we've been together for 30-some-odd years.
All right, good memories at the Blind Tiger. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
Show at the Blind Tiger live with Dave Broderick. All right, so you guys are up in Vermont and you're making beer too.
Yeah, so you know, Chad and I and Ian have always been you know, sort of restaurateurs involved on the service side of the business, and then all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, but lately we've been on the supply side, you know, starting breweries and stuff, and I've always wanted to do it. I mean, I actually got into this business wanting to do a brew pub back in the 90s, even before the Tiger. And then I couldn't raise the money for it. Nobody would give me the money. And so I did the Tiger instead. But I've had like three or four business plans that I've worked on over the years to do a brew pub, and really thought that time had passed. It wasn't going to happen. And then got lucky. You know, when Dave Arrington all of a sudden said, "Hey, we could do this," and so it's always been a dream, and it's great because you get to sort of see the other side of the equation. You know, making something and sort of getting your input on that. And so I kind of wanted to ask. Chad's going through the same thing, and he's been working on it. I know he's been thinking about it forever, ever since he worked at American Flatbread, and which is a brew pub. And so I just kind of wanted to see what, you know, now that you're doing it, how do you feel about it?
I love it. It was definitely a learning curve. You know, looking at Flatbread, it's one of the best business models out there. Is those guys, they're still brewing beer, and actually they just ramped up their production. By the way, we talked about all these great Vermont beers. We should mention, you know, Zero Gravity and the beer that they're putting out right now.
Paul Saylor and Matt Wilson, great stuff. Destiny Saxon.
They've been in it. Paul Saylor's been in the brewing scene for a long time. He even brewed at Commonwealth down
here in New York. I met him actually when he brewed was head brewer at Commonwealth up in Rockefeller Center.
But definitely learning experience building out a brewery. Just buying the equipment. Sort of knew some of the stuff we wanted, but you got to do a lot of research, ask questions, and I don't recommend building out rehabbing a 200-year-old schoolhouse at the same time, but that's done now. So, you know, definitely there's challenges of sourcing the supplies. You know, hops have become one of these things where even a year ago when I bought into our hop allocation, they were 4 years out on certain things. Now they're 10 years out. They're making people pre-buy 10 years in advance. That's becoming a big challenge.
Is that why, Dave? That's why you're doing coffee beans?
Exactly. There's a lot of coffee beans out there.
I've seen people make dandelion grits. People using a lot of other flavors instead of hops.
Yeah,
I think it makes total sense too. I mean, you know, if you're trying to derive a citrus flavor, then why not just go straight to the source? That was part of the conversation I had with my brewer the other day, just saying, hey, you know, we should probably do more beers like that, the beer that we did with the orange zest. So, but, you know, I've loved the whole experience of getting in on the brewing side of it, and, you know, it's been very good for us.
Yeah, I mean, beer really is cooking, you know, much more than, say, winemaking, which is more of an agricultural thing. But beer is really cooking, and that's what we've always been, you know, doing is food in various ways. And so I think, you know, making beer is a really good extension of what we were already doing. It's just on the liquid side. And I think, you know, Chad and I have gone back and forth about this over the years, but it's great to, you know, gives you another sort of control of the bit, you know, part of the business, you know, sort of your foray into it. It's, we're always trying to figure out ways to keep the places profitable, which is, gets harder and harder as costs keep going up. You have to sort of keep finding ways to increase your margins, and obviously making beer is like can be hugely profitable if you do it right.
What about sales and the distribution? And that's coming up, too.
Yeah. I mean, it also, you know, as we kind of, you know, we started in Vermont, but we're starting to kind of expand into other markets. You really realize the difference in the liquor laws from state to state and what you're allowed to do. Like, for example, in New York, you expect a brewer to come through. They have their business card and a sample of beer. In Vermont, you're trying to sell beer, it's not something you can do because it's, you know, they're just like so
crazy little laws.
They're just crazy little laws in every state, but which can be prohibitive, but it's also kind
of. So in Vermont, how will you sell the beanery outside of your own? Can you sell it in your own?
We can sell, yeah. Since we actually make it in Portsmouth, New Hampshire at Smut Labs, so we don't have a manufacturing facility in Vermont, which means we're allowed to sell at both of our places as well as anywhere else. The minute if we were to do a brewery in Vermont, and you know, eventually I think that is the plan, then we wouldn't be able to sell. And that's just a Vermont law. We wouldn't be able to sell at either of the Worthy Kitchen or the Worthy Burger.
So coming to New York, though,
here it's not a problem at all. Obviously, I can sell it at the Tiger. And
so you just have
else.
A distributor in New York.
Yeah, we signed with Union Beer out of Brooklyn, and so we'll go with them hopefully, late April, early May, we'll be here.
This stuff is mad crazy. What is this? The coffee milk stout.
Amazing.
So this is the coffee milk stout,
this is how I want to drink. So there's really caffeine in here.
Oh yeah.
This is how I want to drink my coffee.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the best way, Jimmy.
Sometimes I actually have a beer in one hand and a coffee in the other.
See, now you don't have to do that. I'm trying to make you more efficient.
You're waking me up too. It's about 12:30, I think.
Exactly.
The day after Brewer's Choice, so we're all struggling.
I think that's really the flavor that you get is really coming from those beans.
Right.
And Ethiopia, a lot of people taste it. And what I hear at the bar, a lot of people almost think that it's somehow coming out of a barrel.
Right.
A barrel-ish flavor, but it's that kind of berry note coming from those Ethiopian beans.
It's like naturally processed. So they let the beans, before they, you know, de-husk them, they let them sit out in the sun and ferment a little bit. So you get a little, that's where you get that tart berry flavor. And the thing about when you're making coffee beer, is, and this is sort of the new wave in coffee, is to really lightly roast the beans, don't burn them, and which gives you a lot of different flavors. And Claudia, our roaster, is really big about that. It's like she's really looking for different flavors than maybe some of the old school roasters that to like to cook them a little bit more. So it really makes sense for the for when you're, you know, combining it with coffee with beer.
So Dave Yarrington's going to be doing more special projects like this at Smut Labs?
I think, yeah, he's got his own, you know, Smut Labs is all about, that's all they do is one-offs, pretty much. And then Paul Saylor, you know, Zero Gravity was brewing down there as well. He was doing those beers for him. Conehead, which is his flagship, Paul's flagship. And I don't think he's going to get many more contract breweries in there, but definitely his own small batch series, short batch he calls it. Lots of Berliner Weisses and some kind of cool, you know, stuff that he can't do on his giant system at Toll Farm.
A lot of great sour beers.
Yeah, a lot of great. He's really he's into Brett beers. His head brewer Charlie Ireland is all about that. And Chad was just telling us that Brian Strumke Stillwater is going to be brewing there next week.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what they're gonna make?
I do not. I'm just the mule that's driving him down there.
So. Because you love to drive.
Well, hey.
And you got a good rig now.
Coffee and beer.
Brian's coming to brew with us, so, you know.
Right.
So
what's he going to make with you?
We're doing a hoppy Saison.
Nice.
We still love our hops, and we love Saisons.
Yeah.
Chad, what about you? So for distributing your beer, so you make it, Is your brewery and restaurant the same thing, or are they separate?
They're, you know, the beer actually travels underground over to the restaurant and ties into the tap lines there to make it a brew pub. But the brewery out back is its own entity as well. It's just a down and dirty, you know, bar space with where you can see the brew house.
You have drive lines underground from the brewery.
Wow. Yeah. So
he's pretty cutting edge.
How long
or
is the line?
Ghetto rigged.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
How long is the line?
They run about 50 feet. They run from the cold room, which is right underneath where when you walk in the door, there's a cooler there that's about 400 square feet down underneath you with the bright tanks, conditioning tanks. And then the fermenters are down in the basement as well. But the brew house is right up there where you can see it. So you can come in. There's bar seats in there. Originally we were going to do a tasting room. But then we're like, well, why not just have a whole glass and get food while you're here? And as well, it gave us outdoor seating. So now you can come in there, have a pint, heckle Nate while he's brewing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but actually, I mean, you're immersed in it. You smell the grain mashing in and the hops boiling and the whole process. I mean, it's literally like 15 feet from where you're sitting.
But do you sell your beer anywhere else?
Not yet. Down the road, we do plan on doing it. Really want to come down here to New York to do events like at the Tiger and whatnot just to promote stuff. But we're trying to grow into it and keep it small at first. There's advantages to doing that. We really want to keep working on our recipes, and you know, before we just get crazy with this, we don't want to grow too fast. I feel like that's where you start to lose control with what's going on. So doing the smaller batches right there in house, a lot of benefits for us that way. We want to Dave touched on the fact that Vermont depends on having people come from out of state. It's a very small state. Tourism is probably its biggest industry, and so the more reasons that people have to go to Vermont, you know, it's better for us to serve it there at the Pig for right now, and hopefully make people want to go there, give them a reason.
Yeah, I mean, we're really glad that a lot of our popular breweries don't distribute outside, or you know, just very little, just enough to lure people up, and that's pretty much their whole business model so far. It'll be interesting now that they're all kind of expanding. So, and I know Lawson now is actually in Connecticut, where his Sip of Sunshine is made. But for the most part, you know, so far they're trying to keep it in Vermont to bring people out.
I think it's nice having these breweries that are just kind of regional, you know, local.
Yep.
And I've seen that in New York City now too. There's guys like Transmitter that, to me, are as much in demand as Hill Farmstead is.
Totally. And yeah, that was the great thing about last night at the Brewer's Choice is, you know, just the New York City beer scene, New York State beer scene has just changed so much, and it is so similar to the scene that we have up in Vermont. And exact same things are going on, and you've got like certain brands just blowing up. Everybody wants them. People waiting in lines at the breweries, at the tap rooms. Sam from Other Half was saying how last night he was telling me how much pressure he feels when he sees, you know, it's 2 degrees outside and there's a line to get in for a can release. And he's like, you know, what if they don't like it? You know, and you look out there and you see all these people just waiting for hours for your beer. And, you know, you start to feel a little pressure. We don't have that problem at Beatery, so we don't feel any pressure.
Well, cheers. Yeah, now, Ian, yeah. So tell us a little bit about what's going on with Worthy Kitchen, Worthy Burger.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
talk about going up to Vermont. I got to go up.
I know, Jimmy. You know, what are you doing? Come on.
I had only signed on for a year, and here I am 18 months later. I really think just what these guys were talking about, just really the local produce, just the food, and everything we have access to just makes it really a great place to live. We do kind of, you know, working in the bar scene, we do live off kind of the tourism of people coming up. But at this point, I think just as much as the skiing or the mountain biking, hiking, people are coming up for the food and the beer. And
you guys mentioned some of the breweries and the restaurants. Give a shout-out to a couple of the farmers that you guys work with up there.
Well, we got Steve Hampsch, who's right in Barnard, Fable Farm, obviously. It's actually Heartwood Fable Farm now. A lot of our vegetables come from. Kiss the Cow, chickens, and it's a raw milk dairy. Eastman Farm, grass-fed beef. Those are a lot of the Barnard farms. And then Tamarack for lamb.
You know, it's really nice that you can kind of wrap your head around the whole economy up there.
Right.
From, you know, from the greens to the grains to the meat. You know the farmers, you meet them, they come in, they drink your beer, you use their products in your beer, and it's kind of like a microcosm, where in New York it could be a little more unclear.
It's maybe a little bit less connected that way, where you're not like constantly hanging, because there's so few places to go up there. So, you know, you all hang out together. You all know each other really well. You're all friends. And you're all, I mean, we started Worthy Burger to take care of those farms that I just mentioned. We're having trouble, you know, selling their excess stuff. They all have CSAs and all of that. But then they always have some left over that they were looking to move. And they just, a lot of the local restaurants were like, oh, it's too expensive. And so that was part of our challenge, was to create a business model that could buy, you know, local farm food from our friends, pay them a decent price, and then turn around and us turn it into food that people could still afford. That they could. The whole idea was that to create a restaurant where the farmers could afford to eat there, both sell their food to us, and then in turn we didn't jack it up so much that they couldn't afford to eat there. So, because there's a lot of farm-to-table restaurants, but most of them are fairly expensive. And so that was, you know, we work on that all the time. It's still really tough. For them to make money, they need to really, you know, sell at a premium. And so it's a real challenge keeping your food costs at a decent price.
Well, I'll tell you guys, it's a nice show. Thanks for inviting me to the Blind Tiger, Dave. And I know that I think Chad Rich only come down, what, once a year now? Twice a year?
Are you kidding me? He comes down here more than I do. Every time I see him, every time he's texting me from New York.
I was here the past 3 weekends.
You guys are all right. We had a lot of fun this week, New York City Brewer's Choice. We're talking about Vermont. So if we go up to Vermont, we should make our landing points Worthy Burger, Worthy Kitchen, Prohibition Pig, and get the lay of the land up there.
Yep.
All right. In closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors who've helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to Chad, Dave, Tommy, and Ian for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Maggie Seiden and Justin Kennedy, and to our engineer, Jack Inslee. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.